So, there we go, business law, PP torts.
It's yours. It's not in any order. Why? I don't know. I got homeworks, I got quizzes.
I remember to bring it.
Alright. What we need to do today is we need to begin torts. Our next substantive law unit. Why torts? Well, we've already done crimes. And to be honest with you, torts basically are the civil side of causes of action. What is a crime? We've already defined it in here. What is a crime? Nobody can give me a definition for what a crime is. Goes against law. Who establishes that? The government does. So it's a crime against the government. The government said, thou shall not do this behavior. And if you do that act, you're committing an act against the sovereign, against the right of the government to regulate our behavior. Well, what happens if what you did is detrimental to the individual? Well, that's what torts are all about. And by the way, you can do one thing, and it can be both a crime and a civil offense. Meaning the person who you did that action to can turn around and sue you. So if it's a crime, it's going to be the state. It's going to be the prosecution that's going to be looking to punish you. But for those same actions, the individual could bring a claim against you and hold you liable for a breach of duty, inappropriate behavior that the society just kind of says, because ultimately, torts are a process of getting a remedy. If you do damage to me, I deserve compensation. A crime is a criminal wrong. A tort is a civil wrong. It involves the establishment of standards of conduct. Levels of behavior that we as individuals, as human beings, as part of our society, are expected to adhere to. And if we don't, we're in breach of those standards. And when there's a breach, the law provides a remedy. A way for the injured party to get compensation. Have I lost anybody yet? Do we have any questions yet? All right, seeing none. I actually got to take this. I apologize. Hello, Jesse Lamanic.
How you doing? It's Alex Vericott. I had missed a call from you a few minutes ago. I was waiting for a call back from your area, so I wasn't sure if you're the gentleman who was going to be calling me regarding the notary public.
Well, I'm an attorney, but yes, I'll be coming to your house to do the closing.
Okay. Yep.
3 o'clock, right?
3 o'clock, yes, sir.
All right, excellent. So like I said in the message, I'll send you a text when I'm heading your way.
Okay, I did not get that.
Oh, I got it. Oh, I got you. I did leave a voicemail. I thought it went through.
Gotcha. So I actually had 2 calls come in at the same time, and I was having something at work, so I hit decline. So I apologize, but I just checked my voice, so I didn't have one.
Okay, no worries.
I saw a location graph yesterday. I thought this was the law firm.
Yeah, that is my law firm. I my phone is out of Grafton, though. All right, so I look forward to meeting you at 3.
Okay.
Yes, I do. Sounds good. Yep, bye. That's not the call I wanted. I apologize.
All right. Again, see, that's the downside of doing what I do. My phone goes on all the time, and it's so annoying. I hate phones. All right. Standards of conduct. Standards of conduct. Things that you must do. You have to act in a responsible manner. Because if you don't adhere to the rules of civil society, you will be held responsible for those behaviors. Now, you don't, again, it's called a breach. Breach of duty, breach of responsibilities. We've been using these terms. And the law will provide a remedy. More often than not, compensation. We'll talk about the different types of damages soon. But the most popular, common form of a remedy is what's called compensatory damages. Basically, you caused $1,000 worth of damage to my car, you pay me $1,000. Compensation. All right. The person who commits the tort is called the tortfeasor. By the way, that's similar to the person who commits the crime is called a criminal. Although, we use politically correct phrasing. The alleged criminal. So I suppose we could say if you are accused of committing a tort, you will be called the alleged tortfeasor. And what are you doing? You're causing the tortious act. The civil wrong.
Because this tortious act is the breach of contract. And by the way, you can be guilty of a tort by either doing something that you're not supposed to do or the omission. In other words, not doing what you should do. If you're supposed to do something you don't, you could be liable. So don't think it's just because you do something. No, it could mean that you did not do what you were supposed to do. That could also give rise to a tort.
And just like the crimes, the plaintiff who's bringing the case against the tortfeasor has to establish the cause of action by showing the presence of all of the essential elements that make up the tort. But unlike the burden of proof for a crime, which is what? Burden of proof, crime?
Irrefutable evidence.
No.
Reasonable doubt.
Beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the phrase I want you to remember. Beyond a reasonable doubt. What's the burden of proof for a civil infraction?
Preponderance of
the evidence. So you have to be able to convince the majority of the jury, 10 out of 12 or 5 out of 6, that what you claim could have happened more likely than not. Not to the level of irrefutable evidence. So I'll throw kudos out for that. All right. Now, just like bystander's rule of obligation, the only way that you could be liable for a tort is if you have a duty. And you do something that breaches that duty. And that breach is the proximate cause of the harm. So you're supposed to act a certain way and you don't. And it's that not acting the right way that results in the injury, the harm. But don't forget, an act that is a tort may also be a crime. And a crime may also be a tort. So if I walk up and I punch you in the face really hard because I am pissed off, I simultaneously committed the crime of battery and the tort of battery. You could call the police could come and arrest me, and I might serve jail time. But then you could turn around and sue me for that as well. And you could claim, medical injuries, loss of wages, all those types of things. So just don't think it's one or the other. It easily could be both. So, the Marathon Bomber, the anniversary of that's coming up soon, a few years ago, when the Zhanaev brothers used the pressure cooker bombs, killed 4 people, injured others. They committed simultaneously a federal crime, terrorism, a state crime, homicide, and they engaged in the tort of wrongful death. But the families did not sue either of them. But they could have. Questions? So why do torts exist? Well, a long time ago, the English judges realized, maybe you're going to do something that's more like a nuisance. Maybe you're going to do something that doesn't rise to the offense that could threaten the sovereignty of the crown. But we still want to hold you accountable for those actions, because you cannot have a society with no accountability. That would be chaos. That would be anarchy. So the courts over the years have established torts. They come from the courts. Comes from the common law. But here's the crazy thing. A crime is the law that was passed by the legislative process. A crime comes from a statute. The common law comes from the judges. So there are new torts created, I'm not going to say all the time, because it's not like they're making like 10 every other week. But torts could be created depending upon circumstances that arise. But the interesting thing is that the old torts are still on the books. So you literally could be held responsible for a wrongful act that was first recognized 1,000 years ago. Why? Because there's always been antisocial behavior. People do not know how to behave, and they have to be held accountable. Because at the end of the day, I don't have a right to do harm to you, just because I feel like it. I didn't do something responsibly. I didn't exercise the proper levels of care. I intentionally interfered with you, your reputation, your property. I don't know, did something that causes your whole life career to be derailed. Well, why should I not be held responsible for that? Why should I not have to suffer some type of consequences? That is what torts is all about. Questions? Okay. Now, there are two types. There are intentional torts, and there is a broad catch-all basin commonly referred to as an unintentional tort. An unintentional tort is negligence. And we'll talk about negligence next. Well, for today, we're going to focus on intentional torts. And by the way, proving intent is the same as it is in the criminal section. Except it doesn't rise to the whole same level. You don't have to prove mens rea, the evil mind. All you need to be able to do is show is the person meant to do what they ended up doing.
And it takes me back to the conversation that we had when Heidi shared the story about how her group tricked her into stealing a cup. It's not about whether you mean to do what actually happened in the outcome. It's, did you mean to set the first domino in motion? Okay, I may not have wanted to hit you in the head with a baseball bat, but I did pick the bat up and turn quickly because I wanted to take the baseball bat. So the accidental conduct would be negligence. But what happens if I took the bat and I wanted to get rid of it and I threw it? I just didn't see you were on the other side of the bushes. Well, you could establish battery. Because did I mean to pick up the bat? Yes. Did I mean to throw the bat? Oh, absolutely. And did the bat happen to come in contact with you? 100%. That's battery. That's a tort. So you got to keep that in mind. When we say intent, it doesn't mean you meant to do what actually happened to the defendant. Sorry, the plaintiff. Rather, defendant meant to do something that started that roll of dominoes falling that resulted in the harm.
Make sense?
So, did Heidi mean to take the cup? Yes, she picked the cup up. Did she know the circumstances about it? No. But did she actually mean to pick it up and take it with her? Yes, she did. That's what we mean by intent. Questions? All right. With intentional torts, again, it doesn't mean that you're trying to be evil. It doesn't mean that you're acting hostily to the other person. It just means you didn't act responsibly. You didn't live up to the standards that society expects you to live up to. And what are the standards that society expects you to live up to? Well, what would a reasonable person do? This is the weirdest thing about torts. It is an objective standard, not based on what you actually did. But rather, it's an objective standard based on what, if you had 30 people in a room and they watched you do what you did, what they would think it was. That's called the reasonable person standard. So, go back to the example that I used on Wednesday. I have a gun, and I'm showing off my cowboy techniques. And boom! It fires and kills one of you. Did I mean to kill you? No. But would a reasonable-minded person think I was active in a way that was socially responsible? Therefore, there's the breach of conduct, which gives rise to liability. So, I'm driving down the road. I'm on the highway, I'm texting, and I take my eyes off the road, and the next thing I know, I smash into the back of a car that had to stop because there was some debris in the road. I kill the person. Did I mean to kill them? No, but did I act responsibly? No, I did not. So therefore, that victim's family has a right to seek compensation for me. And chances are I'll also be guilty of vehicular homicide. Or at the very least, manslaughter.
Why? I didn't do what I should do. As an adult, I should know better.
Now here's the kick. The standards of a reasonable person aren't based on the highest IQ
individuals or the people in society that have the highest IQs in our society. The standard is based on what an average person would mean. So, you could be low intelligence. You could be on some spectrum. But that's not going to eliminate your responsibility. The expectation is when you get to a certain age, if you've been in our society, you've gone to public schools, the expectation is there are certain standards of behavior that you should know are right and other behaviors that are wrong.
And that's what you're going to be held accountable to. So what does this mean? Well, you have to know that you could harm somebody. You have to be able to appreciate the risk. The danger that you could cause by your irresponsible actions. So again, it doesn't mean that you meant to do exactly what happened. It just meant that you did the act that was not responsible. So did I mean to kill the person in my hypothetical? No, I did not. But did I mean to grab my phone and start texting on her when I was driving on the highway at 70 miles an hour? Yes, I did. Should I have known better? Oh, absolutely. Did I act in a responsible manner? No. And I don't think anybody would think that I was. Thus, I breached, and I could be held liable. Questions? But, just like with crimes, which I forgot to include, torts give the defendant a chance to defend themselves. And the weird thing is for just about every single tort, the law does allow for defenses. And if the defense can be established, it eliminates the liability. Now, is there a defense to texting and driving? No. No, there's not. But if I was driving down the road, my hands properly placed on the wheel, fully focused on what was in front of me, and out of one driveway, I see a car backing up without checking to see if there's oncoming traffic, and I veer, and then as I veer, I inadvertently hit a child that runs out between two cars. Did I kill the child? Yes, I did. But will I be held civilly liable for that? No, because I could got the defense. I was trying to avoid another accident, and a reasonable person would be focused on the fact that I almost got T-boned. Cause, action, defense. Would a jury buy it? I think that would be a good argument that could get someone off of that specific situation. Inadvertently cause harm to somebody trying to avoid harm yourself. But when we do the torts, I'll give you the defenses. Questions? All right, so what do we mean by evidence? Well, if you look up the crimes like I gave you on the video, like I asked you to do in your book or with your Google machine, G-O-G-L-E, you will see a definition. Definition of what has to be established in the courtroom. What we learned in law school is you take that definition and you break it up into smaller parts. And that's how you remember these things. Torts are the same way. So I'll give you an example.
We live in interesting times. Times that I never foresaw when I was your age. A time when your whole existence, every action, everything you do, could end up on someone's screen because of those internet and the bless you and the tweets and the snaps and the chats and all the other stuff that's out there on the internet. And because of the internet, people have the power to lie about you. And those lies could cause significant harm to your reputation. And if your reputation is harmed, you potentially could suffer for the rest of your life because of the harm to your reputation. True story. True story. Back many lifetimes ago, back when I was a public school teacher, there was a teacher who taught in the grade below me that was accused by a young lady of sexually assaulting her in the classroom after school. There was no social media, but this child went running to mommy and daddy. Mommy and daddy believed the girl, complained to the principal and the superintendent, didn't do anything, and then tried suing. It got all into the newspapers. His face was in the papers up in Leominster. Face, name, everything about him. Here's the interesting twist. It never actually happened. Never actually happened. Because there were some of his other colleagues that were in the building at the same time after school. And as they walked by, they knew that the only kids that he had in his room at the time, and by the way, as a policy, we left not only our doors to our room open, but also the doors in between. He only had a group of teenage boys in there. And he was doing an extra help session with them.
No girls were present.
Girl lied. Tried destroying him. Well, his reputation was so suffered, he got sick and tired of answering for it. He ended up quitting his job. He was a good teacher. Ended up moving to some other state. Lost track of him.
Is that right? No. Not at all. Now, he thought about suing the family for defamation. But the problem was, is the girl then later admitted, I just made it all up.
And he wasn't the type of adult that didn't think it was right to sue a child.
So you have to be careful. Because who you are and what you have to offer has value.
And if someone says the wrong thing about you, they could destroy you.
They could defame you.
Now, in terms of definition, defamation, which is the tort, there are two forms of defamation. And you've heard these before. Notice, it's not liable, it's libel. And there's slander.
Both are the same, except it's the method that the defamation was expressed. What is libel? Or what is slander? Whichever one you know, if someone could define it, would be lovely.
Is slander when it's the written word? I'm trying to remember. Is this like going back to government class? But it's a written word. Like there's words about you talking bad about a person, but it's got to be,
libel is the written word. Slander is the spoken word.
Libel, it's when defamation is expressed in print, writing, signs, on the internet, pictures,
Slander is done through spoken word.
But regardless of the form, they are both defamation of character. You are defaming the person. You're harming their reputation. Now here's the catch. In order to be liable for slander, the slanderous words must be spoken in someone else other than the plaintiff must hear it. So if for some reason I come up and I say to your face, and it's only me and you in the same room, and I accuse you of being a Yankees fan, I tell you, if you take credit for that, you will lose standing. Your reputation will be harmed. If I knew you were a Yankees fan, I would not hire you. Yankees fan. But if I only said it to your face, nobody else heard it. That is not slander. But it would be slanderous if I said it to your face and one other person was out in the hall and heard it. That's enough. In print, it just has to be accessible. So if you put something on your Twitter or X, whatever the heck it's called, I lose track of them all. I don't really do social. I mean, I do Facebook, but all the other ones. So you put a tweet out. Doesn't matter if somebody read it. All it has to do is be posted. It has to be able to be seen publicly. And that's enough.
All right. So, if you want to sue, alleging defamation, plaintiff must show, by preponderance of the evidence, all of the following. They must prove that defendant made some type of defamatory statement. They must have said or written something that is harmful to that person's reputation. And how do you know something's harmful for your reputation? The easiest and most obvious is, could you lose a job over it? Could you lose friends over it? Could your family members' opinion of you sour? And it must be false. If what you say about the person is truthful, that's not defamation. But rather, defendant must say something knowingly false. So they know it's not the truth. But they don't care. And three, it has to be communicated. Which I've already talked about.
If it's libel, it has to be published in print. If it's slander, somebody else must have heard it. I mean, you can think whatever defamatory thoughts you want, but if it doesn't come out of your mouth or off your fingers, it cannot be defamation.
It has to be communicated, at least to another person. Not just the plaintiff. And there has to be some type of harm.
Harming one's reputation is not enough. You must be able to show that if words were said, the person lost a job. But if it's libel, all you have to show that it's out there, meaning someone could see it.
Question.
So if on a quiz or a test I was to ask you, what is defamation? Bless you. You would simply say, there's a defamatory statement that was false, that was commuted to another, and the plaintiff suffered harm.
Oh! What happens if they're famous, though?
Well, if someone is famous,
There's actually a different standard that's used. So, that's the reason why there are so many people out there for the last 10 years or so that have absolutely lost their mind and suffer what is popularly referred to as TBS, Orange Man Bad. Ah! I'm not going to do politics, but you know what I mean. People just, it's one of those people in society, you love them, you hate them, and there's no in between. And the people who hate them, just hate them. And they say insane things that the other side never said about the other people. It's crazy. It's so bizarre. But he can't turn around and sue everybody that says Orange Man bad. Because there is that presumption that if you are famous, people are going to have opinions of you. And people are going to like you, or they're going to hate you. But, it is possible to sue them if they outright lie, and they use the lie in a way that is malicious. So in other words, you're not just showing that something was defamatory that was said or expressed, that it was a falseness, that it was communicated, that there was harm, but you also have to show that it was said with actual malice. They knew it was a lie and they did it intentionally to destroy them. You know how many millions of dollars the current president of the United States has won in settlements with all of the media companies that published all of those stories about him and his family that was not true? Never went to a jury trial, but they all settled. CNN, MSNBC, ABC. Now, if you have a bad opinion of somebody, that's fine. That's not necessarily what defamation is. If you express your opinion, you are entitled to an opinion. Or if you express something that's truthful, you are entitled to that truthful statement. But you can't seek to destroy somebody just because you don't like them. Even if they are famous. Oh, and by the way, do you know why I said you can say what you want if it's truthful or it's your opinion? Because those are the defenses to defamation. I do not like President Donald J. Trump because he Truth Social? What do they call it? The Truth? I know it's not tweeting. They have a name for whatever the name is. Because he says things that just make my skin crawl. Is what I said defamatory? No, it's just my opinion. But you know what I don't have a right to say? That he's engaged in some type of conspiracy with his quote-unquote puppet masters, Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un, and then turn around and claim he's a king. Won't be a king, it'd be a pilot. Why? If I'm doing it to get a reaction, to get a whole bunch of people to walk out of class, to get a protest going, something that could hurt his business, something that could hurt his family's reputation. Well, then again, pushing the envelope of what is tolerable. You don't have to like someone, but you don't have a right to try to destroy him. Questions? Case in point. Here's a good example of defamation. So, This was an actual case that was decided by the Louisiana Supreme Court in 1977. There was a restaurant in Louisiana by the name of Mashburn's Restaurant. And there was a food critic for a newspaper, New Orleans State's Item, a guy by the name of Richard Collin, who went into the restaurant to try their food and to write a review about said food. And then after review, consuming the food, he wrote a review that essentially trashed what it was that they presented to him. And he used colorful language. Trout a la green plague. Sounds yummy. Yellow duck of death. Salivating. And he used other types of colorful descriptions. And by the way, that was his MO. That's how he operated. Even if he liked the food, he gave him colorful descriptions. It was his writing style. Well, Mashburn was pissed. Because after all, if you're a restaurant, do you want some critic basically not only just saying your food wasn't good, but labeling it as green plague? If you eat this, you're going to die. No, because what customer in their right mind would walk into your business? So he sued. Claimed libel, written form of defamation, defamatory statement, that is false, that was communicated. And thus, it's assumed that the reputation was actually harmed. Well, here's the thing. Collin, lawyers for Collin, critic, his attorneys filed a motion for summary judgment. What's summary judgment? What is summary judgment?
A jury wouldn't reasonably come to that assumption that the evidence doesn't prove it.
So wait, say that one more time?
The jury wouldn't reasonably come to that assumption.
No. The exact opposite.
The judge.
That it's not possible that any jury would ever see it otherwise. The evidence is just so overwhelming. Because the food critic had a defense. An affirmative, absolute defense. The defense of privilege. FYI, privilege is where one is allowed to act. That's all the defense of privilege is. So you did what you were allowed to do. So, what the trial judge recognized was, what's Collin's job? To review food. What did he do? He reviewed food. So how could his reviewing food be defamatory? Because would any reasonable-minded person think that the trout actually tasted like green plague? Would any reasonable-minded adult think that the duck that he had would result in death? No, not at all. Plus, that's his job. No? What is the purpose of having a food critic? Why do newspapers have these men and women on their staff? What happens if you had a restaurant that was actually producing food, selling food, that could kill people, getting people sick? Is it not the news's duty to report what's going on? So the trial judge said, no, forget it. Sorry, Mashburn. No. Summary judgment granted. Well, we wouldn't know about this case if Mashburn did not file an appeal, claiming that there was an error. that summary judgment should not have been granted, that it should have been up to a jury to decide. So you tell me. I've already kind of given all the facts away. Is this review actually liable? The written form of defamation. Yes or no?
I think yeah.
Why?
Because if someone says that the food that you're eating can cause you to die, regardless of how they mean it, a lot of people take that literally. Like that's going to ruin their reputation.
But if it's really, really, really bad, and people could potentially get sick, shouldn't they take that warning seriously?
They should, but I don't think he phrased it in a way that presents that as a serious idea. I think his use of wording wasn't proper to convey that this food isn't safe to eat. He just makes it sound like, oh, it just tastes ass, so I'm going to call it ass.
Okay. You did hear when I said this is how he's always done his job, right?
Yes,
good and bad.
I don't think he's doing a good job. I don't think that should be...
Okay, all right. So you wouldn't necessarily... All right, so let's say you saw where do they put the review? What's the is it Yelp?
Yeah.
Is that the same? So you saw a review of a restaurant that you liked, got a bad review in Yelp. Would you just ignore it?
No.
Continue to go to the restaurant?
No. I went to Imperial Buffet.
Yeah.
I seen a review about how they have like tongs in the bathrooms, and I haven't eaten there since like at all because I don't like regardless of what they use it for. And however it was presented, I wouldn't eat there because that seems like a safety risk.
How is it any different?
Because they presented it as this is a safety risk, you shouldn't eat here. He just said like...
He's presenting that if you eat this food, you're going to get sick.
Green plague is such an overstatement, though.
Okay, so it's colorful. I mean, maybe the tongs were not literally in the bathroom.
They were, though. There was a picture. That's evidence there. When he's just like, oh, the food's bad and it's gonna get you sick, like.
So, we could get really gross here and say green plague. That he could show video of himself vomiting and you see the green plague.
Yeah, we didn't have that ability in 1977, yeah.
but
I'm sure.
Like,
so
it's like something that's like you're saying evidence back in the 70s. You didn't evidence wasn't as blatant as it is now.
Yeah, easy to get. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not as. There, but in my opinion, it's his opinion, so that I would think that they wouldn't hold him liable because it's an opinion piece. It's like an editor. It's like a movie critic. Like you can't go after a movie critic who is going unless they really defame them in like a personal manner, as opposed to just kind of talking about the movie.
Did they talk about the individual chef? Did they talk about any of the people? They only talked about the food.
Well, to counter what she said.
If
I went to a movie, if I saw a review of a movie and it said this movie gave my kid like PTSD, I don't know whatever like you could get from a movie.
Alien,
like,
the original one. Alien, the original.
Yeah, like if I was.
I saw that when I was like 7 years old. Trump.
For Alien, and it was like this movie gave my child a mental condition. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't go to see the movie. But if I'm seeing a food critic saying that like, oh, this food is gonna kill you. And like the guy's not dead. He doesn't have the plague or anything. Like, how would he know?
Okay, I don't buy that. Yeah.
In Colin's defense, he always writes his reviews like that in colorful language. So even if he says something that's bad, he's still being himself. Just the same as if he were eating something that was good, he would review it good. Like the critic from Ratatouille.
So. I like that. That was a good reference. Okay, so it's not out of the norm. It's not like the Mashburn can prove that he targeted him. This is how he always did it. Okay.
One more thing, I'll stop arguing after
no,
this.
No, it's fine.
What if people saw that they sued him for this, and then they realized, like, that he shouldn't be talking about our food like this either, and they ended up suing him because they realized, like he shouldn't...
Wait, who's suing him?
If previous restaurants that he's reviewed in that manner saw that, like, they're allowed to sue for this, and then they sued him for talking like that. So, yes, he might have done it in the past, But that doesn't make it right that he did it in the past.
All right, well, hold on. If the court, to your point, again, the whole purpose of torts is to establish certain standards of behavior. If the court would allow restaurants who got bad reviews to sue the reviewer, whether their food was good or not, how could that be harmful to society?
Because any restaurant who felt like they got a bad review could sue.
Right, and what happens if they actually deserved it? People could go and get sick. And thus, it's harming the greater good.
I feel like there's a certain like precedent for it, though, because it's like I said, if he's saying that your food can get me sick and it's not gonna get you sick, and then they sue, and then like, oh, you know, I don't know.
Can I add to what you're saying? It's like I understand that, but it's an opinion because I can go to a restaurant and I can't eat a lot of different foods. I'm a very bland eater because I get very sick from things. If I were to go and review something, that doesn't, and like my family knows, my friends know, not to always go by what my opinion is because they can eat all that stuff. So it's an opinion and you have to take it for that as in its opinion, not the Bible, you know, to kind of put it that way. You just have to.
And he's actually paid to give his opinion.
Yeah.
Last point.
And As much as I understand that, you're saying my friends and family know this. These are random people who they can't just take your word of, oh, like I get sick because I'm this way. But this is a guy being, like he said, this is a guy being paid to review. Like these aren't just, oh, like personally I think this. Like you, or well, I mean it is, but like
that's all that he's getting paid to offer his opinion.
Yeah.
Now, do you have to agree with his opinion?
No.
Can you continue to go to that restaurant?
Yes.
So. I'll give you one example from my own. It actually happened to me yesterday. So I'm at my American Legion post because we were doing a fundraiser for little kids with Down syndrome. Very successful event. Very happy to be there. And I happen to be enjoying a slice of pizza that came from one of the town staples in Sun. Honey's Pizza on 146. There are many people in my town that hate Tony's Pizza. They find it very blah. I like the consistency. Is it the best pizza? No, but it's good. And sometimes you have a hankering for something that's good. So am I gonna, in fact, one of my buddies was on the table. How can you eat Tony's pizza? Just like, it's like they tell me, I'm like, it's, I'm happy. It's in my belly, it made me feel good. So, you know, one person's good is another person's blah. But both have the right to say, good or blah. Make sense? The key is, the intent was not to go after the person. The intent was to establish a warning to the community that if you go, you may get sick.
So guess what the Supreme Court said? Too bad. Because there was a precedent established in the law by the Supreme Court of the United States. And this is an exception for defamation that allows the media to get away with things that other people cannot. And it's known as the New York Times Gertz privilege. Why? Well, because the case was New York Times v. Gertz. According to the New York Times, if a media source publishes mere expressions of opinion made by a member of their staff, concerning something that has a public value, that source can only be liable if it was said recklessly, maliciously. But if it was not, if it was just said and you didn't know, and you weren't trying to engage in restless falsity, then you cannot be held liable. So,
So was Colin trying to provide a public service? Absolutely, 100%. He was just warning people in a colorful way. Just don't go there. It might not sit well on your tummy. You might have to run out of the classroom. A little boys, a little girls.
Questions? All right.
Now, there are hundreds and hundreds of torts, just like there are hundreds and hundreds of crimes. But just like I did on the criminal video, I'm only going to want you to know a certain amount. The ones that could impact businesses.
Businesses.
False imprisonment. False imprisonment is a tort that could impact a business.
What do stores do if they suspect that you are shoplifting?
They follow you, and what could they potentially do?
They can't really do anything.
Pull you into an office.
They could call the police, that's about it. They can't.
It depends. If they have a trained security guard and you give consent to go with them to the back room, then they can stop you. They can hold you.
But if you try tackling them, then you will get yourself in trouble.
False imprisonment. False imprisonment. False imprisonment is a situation where there's an unlawful detention of a person.
False imprisonment, an unlawful detention of a person.
Question about that.
Let me finish. Depriving of their liberty, depriving them of their liberty
against their will.
An unlawful detention of a person. Depriving them of personal liberty against their will.
Answer.
So, like you're saying, that there's the person that's securing the store.
Like a security guard.
Yeah. There's a word for that. So, they could hold the person.
They could hold the person.
Decides just to walk out, they cannot go after.
Correct. Correct. Unless that person has been trained, because there are companies that will train security personnel on proper detention methods.
So if a store has a trained security guard, they do have the right to stop. But a cashier, sales clerk does not have the right to do that. And ultimately, if the person that's accused says, okay, and goes behind, back room, whatever, then they can be detained until the police come.
But the moment confinement lasts beyond consent,
then you could potentially give rise to false imprisonment.
Now here's the catch. There's always catches. You have to be aware of the suffering. You have to be aware of the suffering.
So if you are falsely imprisoned, you must be aware that you are falsely imprisoned. If you did not know you were falsely imprisoned, you do not have a claim. So, case in point. Thank you for the round of applause, but hold off. I got a good one for you. You fall asleep in class. You come take a night class. The professor sees you sleeping like a little lovely child and decides not to disturb you. And just leaves you alone. Walks out. 11 o'clock, campus security clicks the button, all the doors lock. You are locked in overnight. But you sleep soundly, like a baby, all the way until 8 o'clock. Because at 7 o'clock, when the doors open up, the 8 o'clock class that's in this room comes up and sees you and pokes you. Dude, why are you in this class? And you wake up and you're like, oh, geez, I don't know.
Can you turn around and sue the college for locking you in against your will overnight?
You didn't even know what happened. You have no plan.
You have to be aware. Oh, and by the way, to go back to the shoplifter situation, if you are in a state that has a shoplifter statute, the store actually may be able to detain you. And Massachusetts is one of them. But Massachusetts law provides it has to be by a security personnel. Now, how can the store get away with it? There has to be a reasonable basis for suspicion. There has to be a reasonable basis for suspicion. And the detainment must be reasonable. So, one of the employees, be it the eye in the sky or one of the employees, or a customer, has to have seen you do one of these. Yoink. And then you have to be asked to the back room. You have to go to an office, sit in a chair. They can't lock you in the cooler. Throw you down in the basement. Shut the lights off. Can't do that. But so long as there's reasonable suspicion and a reasonable detainment, you cannot sue for false imprisonment. Oh, look at that. Look at that. Oh, that was good. Do I have it all? I do. Wow, go me. Should really update my my notes compared to what's on the screen. Yeah, I just know it's coming. The shopkeeper's a set exception. I already said that. Oh, no, I'm not sure that's right. That was a good story. I like that story. It cracks me up. Ah, what the hell. So back when I was your age, when I was finishing up my undergrad, I actually had a job at a package store. And that was always fun. But I'm sitting there behind the counter one day, behind the cash register. Of course, we had the big cigarette rack, so you really couldn't see anything. But I was sitting down on the stool, so I had a pretty good view of the store. And I see this kid coming. And he's walking suspiciously on the front row. So I can't necessarily see what he's doing below, like, the shoulders. But I'm watching him. He's looking really suspicious. One, because he looks really young. And two, he kept stopping and going, stopping and going. Now, I happen to know what's on that front shelf. Because that's where we put all the booze that had been in the package store for about 15, 20 years. So that was kind of like the clearance area. Well, lo and behold, the kid stops, his shoulders act weird, and then he turns around and starts walking out the door. I jump over the counter. When I was younger, I was actually in shape. I wasn't quite so round. And me and gravity, unlike today, we were not so tight. Today, gravity and I, wicked tight. Back then, leaped over the counter, sprinted out after him. He goes out onto the street, goes across the street. I'm in hot pursuit. I'm gaining on him. Then he decides to go down an alleyway in between a bank and the library, but unbeknownst to him, there was a chain link fence that was locked. So he realizes he's at a dead end, he turns around, and I go airborne. I hit him so hard, right in the chest. And we go boom. Why? Because I play football. I don't know how to tackle people. Then, as he's sitting there like, woo! I grabbed the bottle out of his jacket, and I simply said, I don't want to fucking see you in my store again. And I walk away. Could I have been held liable for false imprisonment? Definitely did a battery. Definitely did an assault. But could I be held liable for false imprisonment? Did I have reasonable suspicion to think that he engaged in a crime?
Yeah.
What was my form of detention? Was that reasonable?
No.
Not at all. He could also sue for false imprisonment. But amazingly, the kid never showed up again. Never saw him again. Now, is there an exception? Yes. As I said, if someone comes up to you and they suspect you of shoplifting and they say, can you come with me? I have some questions for you. And you say, okay. You cannot turn around and sue for false imprisonment. Because you gave consent. You all know what consent means, right? And by the way, I've already defined privilege. Which is the reason why under Massachusetts law, if somebody works for the store and they have security, They do have the right to detain somebody. They are privileged to do so. Questions?
Give you a couple more. Then we'll call it a class. We're almost out of time.
Heavy metal doctor. All right. Intentional infliction of emotional distress.
This one makes me so sad.
Intentional infliction of emotional distress.
What happens if someone does something to an individual and they become literally traumatized as a result of that action? Well, they may have a cause of action against the defendant called the intentional infliction of emotional distress. And it kind of is self-explanatory. The person meant to do something, the defendant, that caused emotional distress. But like with everything, there is a catch. To be found liable for intentional infliction of emotional distress, IIOED, defendant must have acted either intentionally, so they meant to do what it was that they did that caused the emotional distress, or they must have acted in a manner that was reckless. Of course, as determined by a reasonable person standard. But the conduct, the what they did, cannot be a mere intentional act, cannot be a mere reckless act, but the conduct itself must, as it was commonly defined by the courts, it must shock the conscious, a reasonable mind. It must be extreme. It must be outrageous. It must cause the average person to be like, damn, that's harsh. And the cause of the emotional distress was the defendant's action. So not only must defendant do something, meant to do what he did, and what he did is crazy, but the crazy action must be the cause. And here's the last one. And by the way, when we do, I'm going to have you do the criminal cases for Wednesday. I reordered everything. It's now homework assignment number 3. We'll do the criminal ones, and then we'll do the torts after we come back. And you're going to see a case that you will see exactly what I mean by extreme and outrageous. But the emotional distress must be severe. So what do we mean by that? If you are sad, it hurts your feelings. Or if you are offended, it's not enough. By severe emotional distress, we're talking borderline clinical. You have to get psychiatric care. You have to get medication. You cannot function in society. Lose your job. Lose your ability to interact with other people. Something that just causes us to go flutter, like so many people do on social media. It's not enough. All right, we'll come back, we'll pick this up. So for the criminal cases, I think they are 3. And these are not you be the judges, if I remember correctly. So I gave you the full case. So in class, we've been doing the IRAC form. Oh yeah, and I got your papers too. Don't leave without coming and getting your stuff. IRAC, the issue, the rule, the analysis, the conclusion. Well, the court's going to give you the conclusion. So try following that format when you do those three cases for Wednesday. And come up and get your papers if you've given me papers.